Jason Kenney is not a leader in this. He's being dragged along by the scruff of his neck by the senior government and by the companies and so on. So I see Kenney as being kind of a junior player in this.
Forgotten Corner podcast would not exist without our listeners. If you enjoy the work we are doing on this show and would like to support further, please consider a donation through our Patreon account, patreon.com/forgottencornerpod, or visit our website, forgottencornerpod.com. Welcome back to the Forgotten Corner podcast. We are proud members of the Harbinger Media Network, and you can check out other podcasts such as, like, similar to ours, I should say, by checking out the link that we'll provide in the show notes. My name is Scott Schmidt, your co-host, alongside good friend, full-bearded, and co-host Jeremy Appel. How you doing, buddy? You look rugged, but, like, in a good way.
Yeah, I'm tired. I mean, I don't think that's what you're referring to. You're referring
no,
to
you look like you just came back from chopping down a tree, but like,
actually, yeah, that is what I was doing. I was chopping trees. If by trees you mean,
do we need to stop and let you have a pot of coffee and then we'll
restart? I'm actually drinking coffee right now.
Okay, because we're gonna record two podcasts today. Can you handle this?
Yeah, of course.
We're even gonna tell, like, we're gonna jump right in with a pretty what should I say, like, labor intensive subject too, so your brain's gonna have to turn on here.
Yeah, I just may be quieter than usual.
You're always quiet.
Really?
Well, the odd episode. Anyway, all right. Well, it's good to see your face. We won't overdo it. I got to get through all of this, and then I'm going to go play golf today.
I'm going back.
For the first time since pre-pandemic, and I don't think it's going to go very well. So anyway, all right, let's get to this.
Not a real sport.
No, it's leisure activity. I'm going to be drunk. That's the whole point. Like, I'm not claiming. Do I look athletic to you?
Yeah, you kind of do.
Aw, this is sweet. It's like Markham saying, like, I look 26. I can't tell if anybody's being serious, because it's like you want to thank them for the compliment, but it's so off base that you're like, you're probably being sarcastic. Like, by saying I look 26, you're probably actually saying I look 63. So it's good. Anyway. So we got a bit of announcement today this week, or not today this week. There's a bit of announcement this week from the major oil players in Alberta. And so Markham's here to break some of that down. So let's get right to it. Markham Hislop is one of the country's top energy and climate journalists, who regularly features interviews with world-renowned experts through his website, Energy Media, and as host of the podcast, Energy Talks. You can learn all about the man himself by listening to the episode where we had him on last summer, and we will link to that in the show notes. But today we're going to hopefully sift through some of the confusions around this week's announcement from these top oil sands companies that they have laid out their pathway to net zero by 2050. If you listen to this show, you know that at the very least, we are taking this announcement with a grain of salt. Depending on who you listen to, this is at least promising news. So Mr. Hislop, welcome to back to the Forgotten Corner.
Hey, gentlemen. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Well, I really appreciate you. Like, some people agree to do the show nice and early in the morning, but you're smoking early. Like, you've decided to get up at the Pacific Coast time to do this with us, so we really appreciate that. But if you're not as tired as Jeremy, I really would love for you to just sort of break down, if you could, kind of the gist of what this announcement was this week. This pathway to net zero, and I think the three or four companies that are in on this announcement make up for about 95% of all the oil production in the province. You can correct me on that if I'm wrong. But how are they planning on doing this? Let's start with that.
Well, the companies involved are Suncor, Cenovus, CNRL, Imperial Oil, and MEG Energy. And so it's 95% of the oil sands production, which is, you know, pretty much all it takes takes place in Alberta. And they came out on June 9th with a, you know, the net zero policy initiative. And I understand why you take it with a grain of salt. I mean, the oil sands industry has made all sorts of promises, you know, environmental promises in the past. And particularly, I'm thinking about the 37 tailings ponds that contain 1.3 trillion liters of toxic tailings. And they haven't lived up to their promises. And the Alberta government has bent over backwards to relax the rules and make it easy for them. I mean, they have $31 billion of liabilities, environmental liabilities, and only 900 million posted actually with of security posted with the government. And they've engaged in somewhat questionable behavior in trying to obfuscate the fact that they produce some of the dirtiest oil, crude oil on the planet. You know, so, you know, they keep talking about emissions reductions, by which they mean that the emissions per barrel are dropping. You know, so I think it was about 10, 15 years ago, it was 89 kilograms of CO2 equivalent per barrel, and now it's 70. So, you know, I mean, they brought that down, but they've kept increasing production. So, you know, our favorite conspiracy, foreign-funded activist conspiracy narrative, not Vivian Krause, often says that, you know, the oil sands has been somehow penalized because of, you know, the tar sands campaign, when in fact, from 2009 to 2019, oil sands production doubled. And that's why absolute emissions keep going up, even though the emissions per barrel is dropping and will continue to drop. But if you keep producing more of it, then your absolute emissions go up. And it became apparent to everybody. I mean, I've written about this, you know, for years. And when after the federal election in 2019, and the, you know, Trudeau government finally came up with a, you know, a credible plan to get Canada to net zero by 2050, I said, well, you know, this puts Ottawa and Alberta on a collision course over emissions, because, you know, the oil sands make up 11% of Canadian of national emissions. They're now about 80 megatons a year. And the oil and gas industry in general, or the whole Canadian industry, makes up 26% of national emissions. And we can't keep promising to do more and more and not address those issues. So there, you have a good reason to be skeptical. There's also, you know, the industry has got big problems. It's not lived up to its promises in the past. The Alberta government has been sycophantish over the years, even when the NDP were in power. You know, they still treated them with kid gloves. That all of that being said, there's a lot to be optimistic about in here. And I want to go on record as saying that the reason I've been an oil sands supporter is because I could see a future down the road that's very much different than the future we have today. So for instance, they can get to net zero. There are ways, there are technologies and pathways to do that. And that's what this announcement was about. But there's something even more important, and that's a post-combustion future. And, you know, I wrote my book in 2019. It's called The New Alberta Advantage: Technology, Policy, and the Future of the Oil Sands. And I argued in there that, you know, the oil sands CEOs had finally accepted climate science. They'd accepted the need for climate policy. And they actually saw, you know, competitive advantage in being low carbon, if they could get there, that, you know, especially in Asian markets, which is where they wanted to get into. But if there was one thing I could go back and change in that book, it would be that rather than looking ahead to 2050-ish, when, you know, in Alberta, the last drop of oil that gets refined on the planet could be an Alberta drop, which is kind of the way I ended the book, I would have said, you know what, there's a potential here for a post-combustion future. There's a future where the industry can shift from producing bitumen for feedstock for refineries. So, you know, you turn it into gasoline and diesel and burn the stuff. And that's where 80% of our transportation emissions come from, is actually burning those fuels,
right,
in cars and trucks and so on. But you can, the Alberta Innovates has been working on this since 2018, by the time I started writing the book, of turning bitumen into materials. It becomes a feedstock for materials manufacturing. And the big one is carbon fiber. And, you know, I wrote that article in March for Alberta Views magazine, where I talk, it's called Alberta's Carbon Revolution. And I interviewed Alex Walker, who was the vice president of sales and marketing for Zoltec, which is the big U.S. carbon fiber manufacturing company. And they said, yes, we think Alberta is going to solve the technical problems of turning bitumen into carbon fiber. And it will be cheap. It'll be about half the current price. And that makes it then suitable for the automotive market. Because if you're making an electric vehicle, you want that thing to be as light as possible, because that gives you the longest range possible. So you want to make them lighter, and carbon fiber is either replaces all or most of the steel, and therefore it's quite a bit lighter. So in a very ironic and odd way, the oil sands, if they can figure this out, could play an important role in the energy transition by enabling, by making a replacement for steel and aluminum that enables a lot of electric technology like vehicles.
So, well, and we can go, we have actually done a few episodes, right? Like you can go back and listen to the one that we had with Markham on last summer, talking about the potential of the transition. We'll even link to, we had biologist Brent Smith on in December talking about this very thing, taking the oil sands production that we have left and focusing it on exactly what we're talking about, the energy transition. And then of course, we just had Sandy Garasino on a couple of weeks ago to talk about the anti-oil Alberta inquiry. What you're saying today though, is that this pathway that they're taking now is actually a credible pathway, because so what is it? It's a carbon pipeline. They're going to pump it all underground. Is that what's happening here?
Well, it's going to be a number of technologies. So I interviewed a couple of experts, Anina Lothian from the Pembina Institute and Kevin Byrne, who's an economist with the IHS Market, and probably, in my opinion, the foremost expert on oil sands greenhouse gas emissions. And yes, they think it is credible. And the way to frame this, Scott, is I did a podcast with an economist named Jason Dion in February, and he works for Canadian Institute for Climate Choices, and he produced a study that here's how Canada gets net zero. And there are two kinds of technologies in this report. So one is called the sure bets. So like an electric vehicle now, that's almost mature technology. It's cheaper on a per kilometer basis than a gas powered car. It will soon be cheaper to buy it on a lot. You look at Ford's F-150 Lightning e-pickup. It's actually selling for will sell next year for $2,500 less than the gas equivalent on the base model. So, those kinds of technologies are here, they're viable. That's where government should put a lot of its resources and its policy support and subsidies and so on. The other ones are called wildcards, and that's hydrogen and small modular reactors. And there's a whole bunch of technologies that aren't ready, but they show enough promise that Canada and the provinces should continue to invest in them and develop them. And not all of them will come, become viable, but many of them will. And so if you look at the strategy that the oil sands companies announced, it's kind of like that. So there are technologies they've been working on for a long time. And so on the SAGD side, the steam assisted gravity drainage side, that's where you basically pump steam down into a reservoir, and then you kind of you make the bitumen, which is like peanut butter, you make it so that it will flow up in your up to the surface, and you pump it out,
and then you spread it on toast.
Well, you could. I don't think it's going to replace avocado toast any.
I think you can brush your teeth with it though.
Marmite.
Hey, in Alberta, in certain circles, you may ver that probably is the case. So anyway, once you've got it up on your toast, you've got it up to the surface. But you get it up there by burning a lot of natural gas in boilers to create steam. And that's where a lot of the emissions from the oil sands come from on the SAGD side, is burning that natural gas. And over on the mining side, you got to process it, which takes hot water. And so you got to have, you're burning more natural gas over there. So on the SAGD side, they've been experimenting with for years with substituting solvent, like a light hydrocarbon, like, you know, I think Varsol, you know, whatever, something like something that's lighter than oil, pentane, butane, that sort of thing, into the reservoir instead of steam. So it dilutes it instead of you know, making it hotter. And Cenovus has been leading this charge, and they've been slowly rolling it out and testing it. And so they're going to, you know, they, I guess as part of this, they're going to commit to doing that on a bigger scale. They can do things like, Suncor is going to spend a bunch of money to change its cogeneration plant, or it's change its the way it heats water at its base plant. They're going to stop burning petcoke. Like petcoke is incredibly carbon intensive, and they were burning it in their boilers. Well, now they're going to shift to natural gas. So
what is petcoke for those?
It's a byproduct of the,
not
of the
me.
Process, right? Of the,
I know exactly what it is.
We're laughing because we're among the people that are like, yeah, man, no idea what you're talking about. Petcoke. Sorry, go ahead.
No, did Jeremy not say that he knows what petcoke is?
No, he was being sarcastic because we absolutely do not know what
it is. Yeah, I like.
You're the top journalist in energy, buddy. We just bullshit. Like, you know what I mean? We complain. You find out about this stuff. So yeah, what's petcoke?
Well, I mean, it's just, you know, it's almost like a briquette. You know, it's just got a, oh, okay. it's and you burn it.
And but isn't it, a big, so, okay, so it's, they're burning a lot of fossil fuels to do what they do. I mean, we've done that aspect of this show before, and we don't want to waste too much time talking about that.
So it's but not, it's, just to be clear, it's not the type of coke that goes up oil executives' noses.
So it's not peanut butter with a glass of coke. Like, I'm so confused. Right. Wait.
I don't hang out at the petroleum club, so I have no idea,
Jim. I guarantee you it's not like that stuff. But isn't a bunch of this planned carbon capture, though, Markham?
Yes. No, carbon capture would be a wild card. This is one that's a little bit closer because Alberta's been working on this for a long time. I mean, Albertans will remember when I think it was the Stelmet government, you know, committed $2 billion to the Quest project at Shell's Scotsford refinery. And, you know, so they've been learning how to do carbon capture. Costs have been coming down on carbon capture for a long time. It's still a little on the pricey side. But as Kevin Byrne explained, I mean, you know, we're now at a point where it's an engineering issue. Right. That's how you engineer it better and cheaper and you can make it more competitive. So yes, carbon capture appears to be a viable wild card kind of technology. And we'll probably see some of that in, you know, like post 2025, maybe late 2020s, early 2030s.
People are saying that I'm the wild card of this podcast. So
that is true. People have said that. People have said that.
That is a thing people say. It's not something I.
Jeremy, I think of you as the wild man of the podcast.
This is true.
The wild and crazy guy. Yeah, there you go.
Why? Okay. My question about carbon capture is, though, I guess, like, you've captured it. Well, fucking then what, though? Like, eventually, like, does it just? Do you know what I mean? Like, for a layman's person here, explain to me why carbon capture isn't a terrible idea. Because it seems like you're just capturing it. You're all you're doing is delaying the problem, in my view. But I'm an idiot on this, so you explain it to me.
Well, there's a couple of things you can do with it. I mean, you can use some of that CO2 to make stuff. You can make soap, and you can put it into cement, and you know. So there's some things you can do with it. You can, you know, I'm not crazy about this. You can use it for enhanced oil recovery. Like, you pump it back down into the reservoir and you increase the pressure and you get more oil out of a reservoir. You know, that's
right.
I'm not crazy about that. But what you can do is you can store it in old reservoirs. I mean, where did it come from? It came from an oil and gas reservoir.
Sure.
So So all you're doing is pumping it back down in where it came from. And according to my friend Maggie Hanna, who's a veteran geologist in Calgary, she says Alberta has the best rock for this on the planet. And it's you know, it's got good geology for when you pump it back down there, it stays down there. And apparently this is the technology that we, you know, Alberta's developed. And so it's fairly, you know, reliable. We're not going to have like Aliso Canyon, you know, down in near LA, where you think you've got natural gas in a cavern, and next thing you know, you discover that you've got a huge leak.
So, right.
So the experts say that technology will work. And the idea of building a trunk line down, one trunk line down from Fort McMurray, so all the companies can feed into it. And then other producers along the way can feed into it with, you know, feeder trunk pipelines, and then maybe even take it to Edmonton if they can figure out, you know, some way to make use of this. You know, I don't know how much soap you can make with that much CO2, but something like that. So, you know, again, short on details here. You know, they released it was a press release that sort of touched on some of the things they want to do, including this trunk line, but we don't have any details yet that we can, you know, put under the microscope and say, yes, we think it'll work, or no, we don't. And some of this is there are federal provincial industry working groups on it. So there is one on carbon capture and storage for oil and gas. And there are some for some of these other initiatives that they announced, like, well, I guess there's the one for small modular reactors. So the basic approach of putting resources into sure bets and continuing to work on wildcard technologies that we can't count on, we can't say for certain, but show a lot of promise, is at least a good conceptual approach, in my opinion.
Well, so this is the big oil side of the equation, right? The big companies. What about the junior and intermediate oil companies? Because you once pointed out to me on Twitter when I said something about oil executives at least appreciating the risk of climate change compared with some right-wing politicians or you know, minor celebrities who like live in my neighborhood. You pointed out that there's a big contrast between what big oil and that, for lack of a better term, small oil are on these issues. Could you elucidate that a bit?
Well, my basic argument here is that the oil sands companies, I mean, that is big oil, right? I mean, there is no small oil in the oil sands. Back in, you know, 2014, 2015, last time I was here, I told the story about how the five oil sands CEOs got together with the five environmental groups and agreed on a bunch of climate policies, some of which found its way into not least climate leadership plan. So the oil sands companies have seen this coming for a long time, but let's not make them out to be, you know, heroes in this, because
we won't.
I thought,
yeah, you don't have to worry about
don't
that.
Don't worry. Yeah.
But look, they're responding to investor pressure, right? I mean, well, government policy and investor pressure. So we've known now for, you know, 3-4 years. In fact, I'll give you a little anecdote. Eric Denhoff, who we all follow on Twitter, yep, was Deputy Minister of Environment and Climate Change under Notley. And he wrote a couple columns for Energy Media, and he talked about going to New York as part of a delegation. And they would sit with these big investment houses, you know, the giant Wall Street investment houses, and talk about the oil sands. And the he said, you know, this is like 2017, 2018. And already then Wall Street was saying, dude, you got to give us something, because we can't, our investors demand climate policy. They want to see plans to reduce emissions and reduce climate risk, right?
Right.
And climate risk has now entered the lexicon. We talk about it all the time. And so 5 or 6 years ago, the investors were already demanding, you know, climate risk mitigation strategies. And really what all that's happened over the last little while is that slowly, quite quickly intensified. And now you can't, if you don't have a strategy to mitigate climate risk and give money back to investors, you do not get capital. And, you know, oil and gas companies need capital. So to answer your question, Jeremy, the little guys, I did a story on the Alberta Securities Exchange Commission report. It was about the allocation, how much capital was raised in like 2018, 2019, 2017. That was my 5-year period in there. And for 1 year, the juniors raised no capital whatsoever. And the number of juniors fell from 234 or some number like that to like 89. I mean, they lost almost 150 of these companies. They just went bankrupt or failed.
Like foreign energy.
Yeah. So, you know, the industry is consolidating. The model, the old wildcat model or the Alberta model where, you know, four guys, it's always guys. You have a geologist, an accountant, and an engineer and the CEO. And they put a team together, raise $1 million from friends and family, go out and, you know, over 5 years, develop an oil company, get rich, or sell it off, the production off, get rich, and then go back and do it again. That model, that junior model is pretty much done. Companies have to be, medium sized. They have to be, have lots of capitalization, access to capital, well-run, all that kind of stuff.
And how many BPD? Remind us, is a junior or intermediate
under 10,000 barrels a day?
And so is over 10,000, then you're big oil.
Your intermediate is between 10,000 and 100,000, and then over 100,000 is considered a senior.
But like we said, like it, as far as the oil sands is concerned, anyways, big oil is almost all of it
is right? King.
I was right there, like close to 95% or something. Like it's all of it.
Right. But where Jeremy was going with this.
No, I realize that. I'm just
politics, right? Yeah. Jeremy. I mean, you were asking about the politics of this.
Yeah.
I'm just clarifying like who controls what here. That's all.
Right. The oil sands are big oil. That is absolutely correct. So okay. the uber conservative climate denial, wacko politics is mostly confined to the juniors and some of the intermediates, right? Okay. But that's not entirely true. I mean, a source who worked for Cenovus recently, and so I has to remain anonymous, they told me that, you know, within the Cenovus corporate culture, they think that Justin Trudeau intent is to kill the oil sands industry. You know,
he's a lizard person.
Well, there's not much difference in terms of rationale or credibility between them, right. Either one of those two conspiracy narratives. But
they are both true.
There is a fair amount of irrationality in corporate cultures in the Alberta oil patch. The oil sands are much more corporate and science-based and rational than the little guys. Little guys are all run by these, the Brett Wilsons of the world.
Why do you think that is? That climate denial and like fringe far-right conspiracism is somewhat prominent among the smaller producers.
Jeremy, the oil patch, former
smaller producers.
The oil patch all over North America is a weird beast. And so I've spent time down in Midland and Odessa, Texas, you know, the heart of the Permian Basin down there. And it's very much like that. I mean, it's, you know, these guys are all gun-toting, cowboy boot-wearing, you know, good old boys. And, I got a question for you guys. Take a guess at what is the most common photo or painting hanging on the wall of a West Texas engineer's office.
Something racist.
Nudity.
What, John Wayne?
Close. Because
John Wayne is considered to be the epitome of Texas manhood, right? And so they've got, I've seen black velvet John Waynes and pencil John Wayne sketches. That's the culture, right? I mean, it just seems so out of place in 2021, but that's the culture, and it kind of breeds that, you know, climate denialism and, you know, government conspiracy and foreign funded activist conspiracy kind of culture. Whereas when you're in a big corporate culture and you're dealing with, you know, big banks and you're dealing with government you can't get away with quite the same, you know, irrationality that you can when you're a small company and you don't have quite the same contact and pressures on you. So,
okay. We got about 10 minutes. I want to get back on track here. I got a couple of questions about this, and I want to kind of equate this to the government a little too. So my first question would be, I heard you have an interview with somebody who was talking about how this was a marketing opportunity now for the oil sands, because this was the first big group of conglomerate of companies that were going to claim net zero by 2050. This was a big deal. Now, we've all debunked at some point, the three of us, in certain fashions, whether it's just so your show, Jeremy's writing, we've talked lots extensively about Alberta saying that this is the most ethically produced, best oil in the world. And we all know that that's absolute trash. So my question, I guess, would be, is what that general, like Scott something, you had an interview with a business guy. Anyway, he had said, like, this is a big marketing opportunity. Is that something that you can get behind? Like, does Alberta actually have something to promote about its oil sands that isn't a complete bullshit lie now?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's a marketing opportunity in the sense that, you know, people buy crude oil on the basis of, you know, basically the ethical oil argument.
Right.
That's not the case. It goes down. Oil gets bought and traded on the basis of grade and price. That's simple. So where this might turn out to be an opportunity is look at the oil sands companies. When they talk about this process, they talk about becoming more cost and carbon competitive, because they really believe, they've believed for some time, that carbon pricing is going to play a bigger and bigger role in in climate policy. So now we're talking about border adjustment taxes, right? I mean, Europe looks like it's going to bring one in here shortly. Biden and Trudeau are talking about a North American carbon border adjustment tax. So if you're one of these companies and you want to ship export oil, bitumen, it all goes to the States, right? Because whatever isn't used in Canada, most of it goes down to the state. So if you have to pay a carbon border adjustment tax, now that's an extra cost for you. And so they now have an incentive to decarbonize their oil. But if there's that tax in place, Venezuela oil, Mexican oil, Brazilian oil, I mean, all kinds of other heavy crude oils will pay the same tax. And to the extent that they lower their emissions intensity and pay less tax, yes, that makes them more competitive, and that is a marketing opportunity. I mean, presumably it might make them cheaper in the US Gulf Coast market and they sell more oil there.
So I mean, okay. So it's a good thing. Like the way I see this whole thing right now is, okay, we had the episode where we've talked about the fact that, like, this is dragging them kicking and screaming, and we could nationalize this and just do all this shit ourselves. So that, all that stuff aside, it's a good thing that they're doing something. If this is better, it's late in our view, that's great, but this is better than nothing, because they're fine. Like, they are listening to, whether it's reluctance or not, they're listening to what people are saying. They're trying to do something. So we appreciate that they're giving this a whirl. We should get behind that a little bit. Can you talk a little bit before we let you go, just about how this equates to the United Conservatives narrative? And is this something that they're likely to jump on board with and be like, what a great thing? Or does this go against sort of, their view of the future of the oil sands, which seems to be the past. Like, we're going to go, it's going to be 1996 all over again sometime soon.
When I wrote the book in 2019, there was, you know, I supported Rachel Notley's policies, energy and climate policies, because the experts, a lot of economists that I was interviewing, and many of these were conservative economists, said they were good policies and they should be supported. And Kenny ran against those. And he got in and he axed a bunch of really good policy, and he diluted and modified other, you know, policy, made it worse. And I criticized them for that. I've been a very consistent critic of the UCP government's energy and climate policies. They have changed somewhat in the last 6 to 12 years, not because they've had some sort of revelation, you know, some road to Damascus experience where suddenly they understand that climate change is an issue and they need to, you know, the industry needs to lower emissions. It's because they've been forced to. I mean, this is where the government, this is where the industry is going, this is where banks are going, this is where investors are going, that's where the federal government is going. And, you know, they still do their very best, you know, to cast all of this as protecting the status quo. So, for instance, on the hydrogen side, and now, you know, Alberta has a hydrogen strategy, and you see Kenny on Twitter all the time. He was just tweeting this morning about, you know, about hydrogen, what a great thing it is. But it's all tied to Alberta's natural gas. So he sees it as a way of supporting the natural gas industry. And so it's kind of like that. I mean, Jason Kenney is not a leader in this. He's being dragged along by the scruff of his neck by the senior government and by the companies and so on. So I see Kenney as being kind of a junior player in this. And they still, I'm being told by people who are inside the process, you know, when they sit down with you know, cabinet ministers and so on, they're still not up to speed. I mean, they're not doing this enthusiastically. They're not, you know, behind Foursquare. So I would say that this is going to happen almost despite the UCP government rather than because of it.
So, I mean, essentially, like, I mean, you've said it too in the past, since they've came in, that Kenny and his government are a hindrance to the oil industry, not a help, right? They're not just like not helping, they're making it worse. Like, is that accurate? And would that be the view of these companies, that they, like, just get out of our way and let us try to fucking do something? And I'm not a fan of these companies. They've known for 50 years that they should be doing something about this, and they didn't, because they didn't have to, and now they're doing it because we're making them, and different episode. But nonetheless, what they're trying to do now is at least something, and our government seems like they stand in the way of that more than anything.
I tried to make this point earlier and I kind of got distracted, so I want to come back to it, Scott, which is
Jeremy's handsome fucking face today.
My support for the oil sands is predicated on their ability to pivot to a post-combustion future. Like, if all we're doing with all of these initiatives is just making them better oil producers so that we can put that, you know, make gasoline and diesel out of it, I'm tepid support at best. You know, I mean, it's nice that we're going to be better at doing a bad thing, but the opportunity here is to do a really, really good thing. Good thing for the energy transition, good thing for the environment, good thing for a lot of ways. And that is not the vision of the industry. The industry is creeping towards that. And it's certainly not the vision of the Jason Kenney and the UCP government. It is, oddly enough, more of a vision for the federal government. I think the federal government has had a much better handle on the energy transition and the policies and so on than the provincial government has ever had. And it gets no credit in Alberta for that, but I think it should. So let's put that out there. And so basically it's the industry, investors and federal policymakers with Alberta, you know, dragging along like a boat anchor in some respects.
That makes sense. Jeremy, you got any final questions for Mr. Hislop?
You mentioned the feds. So their goal is to get to net zero by 2050. The biggest component of that is gradual but drastic increase. Can something be gradual and drastic? You know, anyways, a significant major increase to the carbon tax. How is that going to get us to net zero?
Right. That's actually a misconception. I did an interview podcast with Dr. Danny Cullenward of Stanford in late 2020. And he had written a book about climate policy. And he said, look, carbon pricing is great, but it's only one of three broad policies that you need. You also need industrial policy. So you need to support the development of new technologies and so on. And you need regulation. And he said, all three of these combined that makes for a robust climate policy. But carbon pricing all on its own isn't going to get us where it needs to go. I mean, we would have to have a carbon price of like $300-$400. And we're not, well, we can get to 170 by 2030, but that's still not enough. And by the way, just in case anybody doesn't understand this, in Alberta, the oil and gas industry doesn't pay the full price. It pays a discounted price. And the discount right now is around 80 or 90%. So it only feels
from the carbon. Was that under Notley too?
Yes, it was designed into the CCIR, which was, and economists agree with it. I mean, it's meant to prevent carbon leakage by, you know, so that the domestic producers aren't penalized against foreign competitors who, you know, don't have any climate policy. And then the idea is that you reduce the discount over time until, you know, a point where the industry feels the full brunt of carbon pricing. So that's one of the reasons why, and it's not just the oil and gas industry, it's like cement, and there are all kinds of other industries that they get discounts, and we don't talk about that.
Fair enough. So I think it's a good time to wrap up. We got to say goodbye this week, and we're going to let Markham go have a walk on the beach with his wife, which, how can you make him sit? I can't believe he's still sitting here after knowing he was going to be going to do that today. So it's the time in the show where we thank those of our patrons who go way above and beyond, to Chris Sturwold, to Nicola D. Nicola, and to Dave Baumiller. You guys are amazing. We really appreciate it. To our other patrons, thank you guys so much. Mr. Hislop, thank you so much for being here today.
I actually enjoy talking to you clowns. This is all, you know, it's always a lot of fun because it's wide ranging and you're skeptics, and you should be. This is a time for cautious optimism, but skeptics still are important, because the companies have to have their feet held to the fire, and we shouldn't be cheerleaders.
I'd consider myself more of a cynic than a skeptic, but
fair enough.
Appreciate the kind words.
Well, I'm definitely a skeptic. Yeah.
Well, that's why we're co-hosts, the skeptic and the cynic.
We should change the name of the show.
What a cheery pair.
Right. It's a happy group. Well, you're not going to get, this is as good as it gets at 9:23 on a Saturday morning when we're doing this again in half an hour. So
fair enough. Well, good luck on the next one.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Hislop. Really appreciate it. I hope this, I do hope that this is something that at least is a benefit. It can't get worse, and it's nice to see them trying. So I'll give them that for now. And you can certainly go back and listen to other episodes we've had to hear our full opinion on how we feel about big oil, but trying is better than doing nothing. So we'll give them that for today. Have a great Saturday, and thanks everyone. We'll see you guys next week.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate you.
Bye-bye.
Anytime, Mr. Hislop. All right.